Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast, the only podcast dedicated to Thelema, Aleister Crowley, the new eon, the occult, and all things Thelemic. My name is John Crow, and I'm your host, and I'm glad you're listening to this third podcast. This podcast has been public for about a week now, and the feedback has been great. Thanks to everyone's comments, please keep them coming. I'll spotlight some of the emails and comments I've received in a few minutes, but first I want to tell you what's on today's podcast. Basically, today's show is in three parts. The first is me going over a number of individual points. The second is a 44-minute interview with occult author Richard Kaczynski. Please note I pronounced his name wrong at the beginning of the interview and have since learned my error. I have been assured the proper pronunciation of his name is Kaczynski. My apologies for that mispronunciation. After the interview, I'll end the podcast with a third and final song from Chakra called Red, White, and Black. Speaking of Chakra, I asked if anyone knew anything about the artists, and I received a good deal of information. In particular, I want to thank Paul, the webmaster of Loshtal.com, for pointing me to the Magic Music Museum. This is a site hosted by the Norwegian OTO that discusses many artists that produce material related to magic and Thelema. According to the site, the group was made up of people around the London-based Sothis magazine. The track Scarlet Woman has songwriting credits to One Grant and One McGee, among others. On the back of their only official release is, of course, a picture of Crowley. It has a sleeve by Steffi Grant and Jan Bailey, and was available only as an acetate. According to another link Paul gave me, the recordings are from 1976. According to the site, the record also has Crowley reciting La Gitana and the Pentagram. Lastly, he gave me a link to two images on 666 Books that has pictures of the actual album. I'll have links to the Magic Music Museum and the pictures on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. All that being said, a few people stated that they were not the biggest fans of the Chakra songs. I certainly understand that people's tastes vary, and the good news for them is that this podcast has the last of the Chakra songs I'm going to play. I have heard from another Thelemic artist and will be using one of his songs in the next podcast, but I need to hear from more musicians. If you know anyone making music, or you make music yourself, please email me. Also, if anyone knows the people from the group Nuit and the group The Ambient Temple of Imagination, please let them know I've emailed them and have not heard back. I'd love to showcase their songs, but I cannot without their permission. Some of the feedback I've received was less than positive. One person posted on the website that I was giving a forum to a person who spouts hate speech. What I find laughable is that this person didn't even have the steel to use their real name. Throwing terms like hate speech around is pretty meaningless when you do it anonymously. Nevertheless, the reality is I support diversity and people's rights to speak their minds, even if I don't like what they say. People who only support free speech when they agree with it are pretty intolerant. I want to foster thought and dialogue with this program, and that cannot be done if everyone is saying the same thing. So if you want me to take any comments serious, be sure to leave your real name. Otherwise, you will be dismissed. More interesting are the comments from Michael Efforts. He thinks the current OTO U.S. Grand Lodge mission statement should be discarded for something more concrete and effective, because it, quote, avows to establish within this country, the United States, a society that will usurp the current one based upon 1. Thelema, 2. The writings of Aleister Crowley, 3. The writings of past OTO leaders and founders. He goes on to say, quote, what worries me most is how the current OTO stands on issues propagated by the past leaders, especially Theodore Royce, who wanted the OTO to manifest in society certain government establishments and ideals that are, frankly, fascist. How many people, for example, in America, would want anything further to do with the OTO if it at this time supports fascist principles? I think it's very important and fair that the OTO should make very clear, in no unveiled or ambiguous language, exactly what changes it wants to effect and where it stands on the pressing issues of our time. Until that is done, I'm not sure that I personally or the public as a whole will come to trust the OTO enough to support what it's doing, let alone how can we support the changes it wants to make if it doesn't say what they are, or worse, if it doesn't even know what they are. Close quote. I think Michael is right that the current leaders are not letting the members or the public know what their plans are. I don't think this is some kind of conspiracy, though. I think it is because they don't have any plans or goals. They just exist day to day. No timeline, no concrete action, just a bunch of promises that the Order is going to do these things, but never a delivery date, and hardly a delivery. As for the fascist aspect, I don't necessarily agree. But it is something to consider. How should the OTO function? As a democracy? Crowley notes correctly that democracy always advances the mediocrity, the people who displease the least. I don't want the OTO run by the mediocre. I want it run by enlightened, disciplined, and capable leaders, not ones who got there because a majority of the people think that the person is the lesser of two or more evils. That is how we got the current Bush administration, and I have to say, I'm not impressed. Crowley was an aristocrat and advocated an aristocracy-based model for the OTO. In Chapter 72 of his Confessions, page 701 in the Penguin edition, he states, quote, "Chief of these kings is the OHO, outer head of the order or freighter superior, who is an absolute autocrat." Close quote. There is no ambiguity here. The OTO is not put there by democracy. The question I guess Michael is asking is, do we want to keep the system as it is, or change the OTO structure to be more democratic? I, for one, do not advocate changing the system. However, my previous guest, Bishop T. Allen Greenfield, does. This is a very important issue for people to look at, because if the OTO is autocratic, then changing to a democratic model would introduce wide-reaching changes. I think people need to look at that more closely. Similarly, the 10th degree of a country or region is appointed by the OHO, again, not elected. Crowley was made 10th degree by Royce, as was Akkad. In recent history, Sabazius was made 10th degree over the United States by Hymenaeus Beta. And now, I am pleased to report to those who did not know, there is a new 10th degree. Brother Hyperion was made the Supreme King of Britain on May 1st. I'd like to congratulate the new king on his appointment and look forward to seeing good things come from the Grand Lodge of the United Kingdom. Switching a moment to books, I'd like to point out the reissue by Red Will Weiser of Akkad's QBL. I'm a big advocate of Akkad's work and think QBL is one of his best books. This edition is introduced and annotated by Lon Milo Duquette. I think his introduction does a very good job of putting Akkad into perspective. Also, his notes are very useful. I am disappointed in some of the changes, though. In the proof copy of QBL I have, Duquette points out that he finds most exciting the, quote, "work currently underway to develop a Kabbalah based upon the letters of the English alphabet," which, while not an Akkad discovery per se, is in part based on his Liber 31. There was also an endnote referring to some of the books published by Luxor Press. This line and the endnote have been removed from the final version. What I find sad is that people are so resistant to experimentation. Anyone who does a small amount of research knows I am a proponent of Nuyon English Kabbalah. Not because I think it is the end-all be-all, but because I think it is a useful tool in exploring Liber All and the Class A texts in a different way. Yet there are those who resist this kind of exploration and dismiss any new changes or discoveries. They present an attitude as if everything that can be discovered about magic has been discovered by Crowley, and there is nothing else to find. They have such an ossified opinion about these subjects that they censor others. Regardless if one sees New Aeon English Kabbalah as a valid system, the flat-out dismissing of it and other new explorations like it is very foolish. One prominent OTO leader once stated to me, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that he thought the closest thing to an English Kabbalah that existed is ASCII. I would not be surprised if it was this same person who had that line and endnote removed from Lon's introduction. Very disappointing indeed. Nevertheless, it is a good book, and I encourage you listeners to get it if you do not already have a copy of QBL. Red Wheel Weiser also has plans to reissue Akkad's other two Kabbalah books. I'll put a link to QBL on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Moving on, the next segment is an interview with author Richard Kaczynski. He is the author of Peridabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley, and many other articles, essays, and lectures. A PhD currently teaching at Yale University, Kaczynski is also a very talented musician with a number of CDs. In this interview, We talk about his background, what led him to become involved with Thelema, the OTO, Magic, what projects he is working on, and also some of his thoughts on Thelema and Thelemites.
We have on the phone with us Richard Kaczynski. Are you there, Richard?
I am here.
Wonderful. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is great, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. But since we are short on time, let's get right into your background. From your website, it says that you've been in Thelema since 1977. How did you get into Thelema?
Well, it's both a short and a roundabout story, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I grew up at a time where the whole metaphysical movement was just very omnipresent. When I was a kid, there were all these Sun International pictures about mysterious monsters in search of Bigfoot, and there was this TV show called In Search Of that was hosted by Leonard Nimoy. I had an older sister who did a school report on witchcraft, and she interviewed a famous Michigan witch by the name of Gundella, and she had this drawer in her room where she had all this incense and tarot cards and a planchette and all this stuff. It was like, the closet of forbidden mystery, and that really captured my attention as a child, from a very early age. And in my early adolescence, I started getting very interested in, UFO phenomenon and psychism, and that then led me to, things like Nostradamus, which then led me to the local occult bookshop. And then it was all over once I set foot into that. There was a local shop by me by the name of the Middle Earth Bookshop, and it was run by a fellow named Paul Hudson, who basically took me under his wing. I went in there, and after buying my Nostradamus book, I found a book on the Golden Dawn. And very shortly after that, he said, if you like that, you need to read this. And he gave me a copy of Crowley's Magic and Theory in Practice, which made no sense to me at all at the time, but I knew there was something about it, and I was hooked. And I remember shortly after that, Paul had gotten in a used set of the Equinox. It was, the 1972 Weiser reprint, and he wanted $100 for it. And, here I'm a 14-year-old kid. I don't have a job. I don't drive or anything. And, I want this other Equinox. So he works out this deal with me where I come out with my $5 allowance, a week. And every 2 weeks, I pay him $10 for a volume of Equinox. And he sold me one volume at a time, gave me the last one for free, just, because I was so earnest. And the rest is history.
Wow. So what is the deciding moment that makes you say 1977? Is that when you actually discovered Magic and Theory in Practice when he gave it to you? Or?
Well, a number of things happened in that year. I had some spiritual experiences of my own involving astral projection and so on that definitely set me onto this path. And it was, again, just within a matter of a couple of months of that happening and me reading about the Golden Dawn and then getting into Aleister Crowley. And when I go back to my magical records, that's the year. It was like August and September of 77 when I, first started recording, really studying Crowley's stuff in earnest.
Mm-hmm. And then jump forward a decade, you joined the OTO in 1987?
Yes, I did. I took my Minerval at Thelema Lodge in Berkeley.
Ah, okay. And were you living out in California at the time, or did you find out about it and fly out there specifically for initiation?
Well, as it turned out, I was there for an academic conference. And I figured, while I'm in San Francisco, Grand Lodge is there, I should do my Minerval while I'm here. So I had met up with them about a month before, because I'd been in town again for academic business, and arranged for the initiation the next time I was going to be back, and took it there at that time.
And so, going to your academic background, right out of high school, you went into college for your undergraduate degree, and was that why you were out in California, or were you already working on your postgraduate degree?
I would have been in graduate school at that time. I was presenting a poster, I think it was like for the Gerontological Society of America or something like that. But, you know, yeah, I went to college majoring in psychology very much with the intention that I thought this would help me understand magic better, you know. And actually what I found out was a lot of the theories of personality and so on that they're teaching in school are still a little bit mired in, you know, classical thought, not quite where they need to be to understand some of the extraordinary things that can happen to consciousness. And in fact, you know, when I applied for my most recent position, they were asking me, well, how does this, you know, religious stuff tie into your career as a psychologist? And what I told them was that studying ordinary consciousness tells us very little about how the brain works. It's when unusual and unexpected things happen that we really see what's going on. And they bought that, and I think that's really my approach to psychology and how it applies to magic. But the field as a whole, I don't know, in my experience, hasn't been, you know, isn't quite there yet. So I've still gotten a good academic training and a good livelihood, so no complaints. And there is a lot of insight to be gained from psychology as well. That's not, you know, doesn't have all the answers.
Right, and you did your PhD dissertation on metaphysics and so forth. Can you expand on that?
Sure. When I was reading about the psychology of metaphysical beliefs, I found a couple of things. One was that when we talked about metaphysical beliefs, they tended to lump superstition, you know, breaking of mirrors, or years of bad luck, and things like that, in with questions about various practices, and they weren't very informed sorts of questions either. Just as an example, one question would say the positions of the planets at the time of your birth, you know, influences, you know, the course of your life, and that's one way of looking at what is astrology. I remember reading a book by, I think it's Dane Rudyard, who said that a natal chart is really more like a clock. It's not that so much that the planets are influencing you, but they're just your indicators of what's out there in the world at the time that you were born. So it's not, you know, it's not like the, so that from the saying a question that the planets determine your life is like saying a clock makes it 9 o'clock. You know, no, it's the clock just tells you what time it is. It doesn't make the time. So likewise, I found not very good questions trying to measure people's beliefs, and they're asking grad students in their psych classes. You know, they're asking psych 101 students what they think about, you know, deep spiritual topics. I thought, man, you got to ask the people who are doing this. It makes no sense to ask, you know, Psych 101 students. So I came up with a better set of questions, and I applied them to people who are, the term I used was behaviorally committed to their beliefs. In other words, they practice what they preach. You know, they walk the walk.
Right.
And a second thing I found in looking at this literature was that there was implicit in all these studies something that's been called the marginality hypothesis, which says that people who believe weird stuff do it because they are, they are a racial minority, they're female, they're uneducated, they don't make much money, basically they're dumb, disenfranchised, and don't know any better. And that's a pretty insulting way of looking at a group of people, and it's rather unprecedented in any field of inquiry, so I wanted to test that hypothesis, and I found out that does that in fact stand up, that people who are practicing these things are just as educated and affluent as anybody else in society.
Right. Now, are you familiar with the Claudia Kowalczyk dissertation? Because she was a sociologist, and she did an investigation. She spent a year with Tehuti Lodge, as well as a group in the Assemblies of God. And her dissertation is about deviant groups, you know, using the term deviant as in veering from the norm, not the pejorative, you know. So, and she kind of spent the whole dissertation looking at why people choose deviant groups to go into, whether it's a Christian group or an occult group like the OTO. And what are their motivations, and what are their backgrounds, and things of that nature. And she has some pretty revealing things about the OTO. And, you know, her background as a sociologist kind of takes her to the conclusion, also being part of the norm, she, you know, questions why people really do this, and I'm not going to get too involved in it. I actually recommend people to go get the dissertation, and on the Thelema Coast to Coast website, I do have the information to obtain it. But what's nice about it is she does a lot of quotes from the people that she interviewed, both in the Assemblies of God and the OTO. And so it kind of gives you a snapshot of what was going through people's heads in a very large lodge in 1993 when she did this study. And you know, in just that and comparing it with things are today, it allows us to kind of see how things have progressed and where they have.
I have to get a copy.
Yeah, I'll talk to you about that afterwards.
Sure.
But, you know, kind of following that along, what has been your impression of the education levels of people in the Thelema community? Is it pretty representative of society in general that there's some, you know, percentage of people that have postgraduate degrees, some percentage with undergraduate degrees, and then some percentage of high school or less? Do you think the percentages are the same, or do you think there's a difference between society in general?
You know, that's very hard to say, you know, because that's, you know, the makeup of a group is going to vary a lot from body to body and the sorts of things they emphasize. And, you know, each you know, camp, oasis, and lodge has its own kind of personality and draws, you know, different, you know, a certain sort of style of people, I think.
I'm trying to take it to a higher level, though, kind of in the Thelema community in general, not particular area, because you're right. I mean, each body is going to attract kind of like-minded people.
Right. And, well, I guess where I was going is I was thinking that, I mean, I'm just thinking of people that I know, and I know a number of individuals with advanced degrees in the order that I just kind of think kind of geographically around, you know, where I've been, people that I know. I could probably name, you know, a couple dozen people with advanced degrees. You know, there's, you know, for instance, there's a psychology guild in the OTO that I'm on the board of directors of, and this is a guild for people who are to lend their expertise to the order as professionals in psychology, and they either need to have an advanced degree in psychology or be in grad school to be members of the guild. And, you know, so there's enough people, you know, at that level, you know, in psychology in particular, to have a guild. And so in that sense, I don't think there's any great discrepancy, you know, and if there is any sort of, you know, a bias toward a, I don't know, perhaps a lack of education, it may be in part due to the age of people, you know, coming into the order, or perhaps just the idea that, and this isn't something that's unique to Thelema, but I find that Wicca and a lot of these other alternative religious groups tend to draw people who are rejecting the norm. And in rejecting the norm, they tend to reject the idea of having affluence and of you know, a lot of the other markers of, you know, what their parents' idea is of, you know, normal society. And I'm not saying that's true of everyone in Wicca or Thelema, but there seems to be an element of that where people are saying, no, I'm not going to live the life that you say I need to live. You know, I have different priorities or different things that matter to me. And that might be reflected in, you know, that's any kind of demographic difference in education.
I think you're hitting something there. Another thing that I've noticed is a lot of people, you know, who kind of saw that in their youth and kind of rejected the norm, or after high school, you know, wanted to engage in the world in a variety of ways, but did not want to go the classical route of going straight into college. A lot of them end up going back to college at an older age to pursue degrees. I can think just, you know, on my blog alone, probably almost a dozen people that have done that. And so, you know, that kind of leads to the next question. What do you think having an academic education brings to a practitioner of the occult, Thelema, even Wicca, as you were saying, or some pagan religion, that you know, just a high school degree or diploma would give you? You know, what do you think the college education, even if it's just undergraduate, what do you think that adds to the understanding of the practitioner?
That's a tough one. I think when you look at the OTO, that we are a very book-oriented sort of group of people. You know, we like to read, I mean, a lot. And again, it may not be the case for everybody, but there does seem to be this tendency to.
Well, I think you're right. I think Selena.
And in that sense, having a background where you might, you know, have some educational training to fill in the holes and understanding, you know, classical culture, history of philosophy. You know, Crowley talks about, you know, the equinox being, you know, the method of science, the aim of religion, you know, and if you're using the method of science, it's really good if you have some training in the scientific method, you know, but all of these things, yeah, you can get from, you can find all these things out very independently, but to have these presented to you in an academic setting that's kind of stripped away of all of the occult trappings, so you're getting, kind of getting this pure, you know, presentation of this information, and then you're able to apply it yourself to your magical practice is very good. You know, you can learn things yourself from books, but it also helps to have teachers.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move forward, and since you mentioned books, let's talk about some of the projects that you've done. I guess your most notable is Porodaba, the biography that you did about Aleister Crowley. What inspired you to write that, and how long ago did you start on it?
Well, actually, I started on it back in about 1987, about the time I took my Minerval degree, in fact. And at that point, I'd been reading Crowley for 10 years, rather a lot. And at about that time, I had read another one of the new Crowley biographies that had come out, and I remember I was flying back. Here we go. It's all coming back to me now. I was flying back home from this trip to California to take my Minerval initiation, and I'm sitting on the plane reading this book, thinking, "This is terrible. I could do a better job than this." And this little voice in my head said, "Why don't you?" And somehow I listened to that little voice. It's not a good idea to listen to the little voices in your head, but this time it was a good thing.
And as far as I can tell, the response to it has been very positive.
Yeah, I've heard lots of good things, and the thing that's been very satisfying for me is that the feedback I've gotten has really focused on exactly the sorts of things I set out to do with the book, so it's really gratifying for me to know that I've succeeded in what I wanted to do with the book.
What do you think makes your biography different than all the other biographies out there?
Well, a couple of things. One is that it's told from the whole life story is being told by someone who's been studying this stuff from the inside. And there's something about the practice of magic that if you haven't been there, you're just not going to get it, and you really can't explain why certain things were important to Crowley in his lifetime without having gone through it yourself. And that's one big advantage. Another is that I really am coming at this with a very neutral sort of approach. I'm not trying to bang a gong, nor am I trying to, you know, grind an axe. You know, I just want to lay out the fact and say, this is it. Draw your own conclusions about whether you like the guy or not, but here's the story, and here's what happened and why it happened. And I think the third thing that's different about this is that, you know, the basic life story of Crowley is known. You know, you can get that from any of these books. There are no gigantic surprises out there, but what I wanted to do was to find out little details and fill in gaps and fill in the cracks. And there's always little tidbits, you know, scattered throughout the book that you don't find anywhere else. And that's, again, one of the things that I really set out to do, and that I think sets this book apart.
What unique or interesting things did you learn while researching and writing it?
I think probably the most interesting thing I came across is the whole story of what happened when Crowley came to Detroit to publish The Blue Equinox. And while he was there, he was also trying to establish an OTO body there, and he had some very prominent local people involved. They're also involved in the Masons. And while I was trying to court them, he was finding he was actually having to revise some of the OTO rituals because they were a little too close to Masonry, and to kind of entice these people to sign up for the OTO, he had to change the initiations enough that there wasn't a apparent conflict in their oaths. And just some of the crazy stuff that happened after that. It all, it typically happens with groups that blows up, and there's, a lot up in the court system where this guy's wife is trying to divorce him and claiming that the OTO ruined his life and told him that, gave him these crazy ideas about having this inalienable right to do whatever he wants. Things like that. It's just, for me, having grown up in the Detroit area and worked in Detroit my whole life, up until, about 2 years ago, to see these old copies of the Detroit News, with OTO all over the headlines, the front page, was just, it was really just astonishing. And it's a story that really hasn't been told before. I mean, it's now, you can also find details about that in Martin Starr's book, The Unknown God, as well. But prior to Perdurabo and The Unknown God, the story hasn't been told. And it's a really, really interesting one, I think.
What are your current projects?
Oh, the latest one that I'm trying to wrap up even as we speak is a edited and annotated edition of The Sword of Song, which Crowley put out in a limited edition of about 100 copies in 1904, and although it's been reprinted in his collected works, the book itself has never been reissued, and it's about his only work that really hasn't been reprinted in a separate volume.
Well, I note that it has an extensive notes section of its own. And
yes.
Crowley makes a comment in the beginning that, that he's going to annotate it to the best of his ability, And so what do your annotations add to it?
Well, one thing that I found going through it is that this book is just chock full of references to things. And, he is hinting, he has names of members of the Golden Dawn, in his poems. He has a lot of Sanskrit terminology. He talks about current events that were current for him that have lost their relevance or meaning in the sands of time. And so anyone who's going to read this book nowadays will find a lot of references to things that don't mean anything without being explained. There's a lot of just terminology that has gone by the wayside and things like that. So, there's probably, including Crowley's notes and mine, probably about 600 endnotes in the book.
Wow.
So it's a lot of material.
So are you adding to some of his notes and expanding some notes and then adding your own also?
In some cases, yes, and I'm being very careful to, put my notes in a certain kind of bracket so,
right.
What I'm saying can be easily distinguished from what Crowley originally had to say. And what's further complicating that is that there were some notes that were part of the first edition, but then when it was reprinted in collected works, Crowley added extra essays and he added just a ton of extra endnotes as well. So there's, two different versions of Crowley endnotes plus my comments. They have to be distinguished, and it's done, and it's interesting. And the book is witty. It's very informative, and it's quite hilarious too. All at the same time, it's a lot like Honk Thumb Pax, in that sense.
And who's publishing it?
It's going to be Neptune Press in London.
Oh, excellent! And what's the expected publish date?
That's yet to be determined. I need to finish a project and deliver it to them, and we'll see a timetable from that point on.
Okay.
So, not sure at this point. I would hope it would be out sometime later this year, probably late this year, but that decision is really out of my hands.
If Neptune's doing it, it's going to be released as a hardcover, right?
Sorry?
It's going to be released as a hardcover since Neptune is doing it?
That's my hope, and again, these are... And they're very much committed to doing a very nice edition.
Right.
So, as much as I am, and fact, I was very heartened in discussions with them, you know, saying, oh, I'm kind of concerned because your original book had, you know, really big page margins. It's kind of wasteful in terms of paper. And they were like, hey, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this right. And so they really want to make it as close to the original edition as possible.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Now, on your website, it also says that you're working on a project with Hymenaeus Beta Crowley on drugs. Is that still a current project?
That's one that we've been working for a long, long time. And where that's going to go, I guess, remains to be seen. The idea was to collect a lot of Crowley's writings on, you know, drugs and drug use and its role in magic and, you know, his cautionary tales to that effect and so on. You know, one of the things that we were going to do was print the full Fountain of Hyacinth. Most commonly distributed as the Fountain of Hyacinth is really just the first of three parts, and wanted to actually put the whole thing out there and with lots of other material. And you know, there have been other projects of more pressing importance, and also in this current sort of climate, you know, one wonders if a book of that nature is, you know, the best thing to be putting out. So, I don't know. It's out. I just don't know when it's actually going to be wrapped up.
All right. Are there any other projects that you're currently working on that you can talk about?
A number of things I'm looking at doing. One is I've been toying with the concept of putting together a study guide or a companion volume to Weber Abba, you know, the big blue brick.
Right.
And that it's a very intimidating tome to get through for a beginner. And the information is really kind of scattered. It's, you know, it's not really a contiguous read, but the information is kind of broken up, and you might find information on the same thing in several different places. And I wanted to come up with some way of making that look a little bit more approachable. And I guess I kind of came at this kind of as an instructor myself, thinking, you know, this book needs a lab manual. And so,
so you're saying more than just like a subject index and everything that was added to Liber Abba, but what more would you be adding? I mean, would you be taking sections of it and kind of paring it down and then giving reference to the other sections, or what's kind of the idea behind that?
It's evolving. I had originally thought about going through the material in the order of the AA curriculum to kind of help structure, you know, what should be looked at first and second and third, and then saying, okay, when you get to, you know, pranayama, you know, where are you going to find stuff on pranayama? Well, you're going to find some of it, you know, in the beginning of the yoga section. You're going to find a chapter on it in magic theory and practice. You're going to find Liberu in the appendix, and it's going to say, here's where these pieces are, but then actually have some original material as well to kind of, you know, tie it together and have some just very practical, you know, information about, you know, things you might encounter while trying to do pranayama or, you know, meditation or something like that, or a particular ritual, you know, to help, just kind of help somebody along on that. But my concern with taking that approach is that, again, the AA is a very specific curriculum, which might not be the best approach for people who are coming at this for the first time, and then maybe, in fact, be a little advanced. So I'm thinking of ways I can approach this, you know, with for more of a beginner rather than a more advanced student coming at, you know, Libra Abba for the first time.
Okay.
The thing I'll never forget is when I read Magic and Theory in Practice, and I knew it meant something. I just didn't know what it meant. I remember getting to the end of the introduction where Crowley signs all of his mottos and, you know, degree symbols at the end of it. I thought, I have no idea what this means, but I'm going to find out.
Right. I had a similar experience reading Magic and Theory in Practice in the early 90s, you know, and I was all excited about it. But, you know, I would read a chapter or two and then, you know, or maybe understand 10% or something. And I was fortunate enough to be involved with the OTO, so then I could immediately go to people and say, hey, you know, and ask them about it. So maybe something like that could be a good resource for people to cross-reference against.
One of the things I love is that in something that Lon Duquette writes in his Understanding Aleister Crowley's Thought Tarot book, a very excellent resource, I should say. And something that he says is that Book of Thoth is different every time he reads it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that the contents of the book change, it's just that his understanding of where he is has changed and grown. Every time he comes back to the book, he gets something different out of it. And I think that's just so true with the Crowley stuff. And I think, again, you know, for as we've kind of talked about, you know, only getting a bit of it the first time through, and he kind of, you know, echoes that same sentiment that every time you go back, there's something more to be found.
Right. Are there any other projects you're working on? Or thinking about working on that you want to talk about?
Yeah. I mean, I've been looking at trying to put together a journal, a local body publication for the body that I got started in Detroit, Blue Equinox Oasis. And some of the things I've been wanting to do have been things like a special issue documenting all the history that went into Detroit. So there's a lot of, again, just reproducing the newspaper articles. I've got the MMM applications of three of the members of the Detroit group, and just kind of getting a lot of the information out there, documenting what exactly happened in more detail than I could, with more resource material than is appropriate for a biography. I've also toyed this idea of doing a volume of Perdurable outtakes, kind of like the bonus material on a DVD. there were two court cases that I had devoted a lot of time to in the early draft of Perdurabo. One was the Jones versus Looking Glass case in 1910-1911, and the other one was the Black Magic Libel case, where Crowley sued Nina Hamnett and Constable and Company for a remark that she made about him being a black magician in her book Laughing Torso. And one thing I did was I essentially reconstructed as much of the testimony as I could. And the reason I did this is that there really isn't any record of things that Crowley, actual dialogue of Crowley's out there. Any dialogue that's in Perdurabo is stuff that's, invented for dramatic effect. But obviously no one was there taking notes of exactly what Crowley said. But this dialogue from the court transcripts really happened. And I just thought it was fascinating stuff. But as I read through the assembled book, the book moves around at a certain clip, and it hit these court cases, and the pace just bogged down seriously. And I realized I really need to trim all that stuff out. And so what's in Perdurabo is a much seriously abbreviated version of those court cases. And part of me wants to just put, a book that's just, here's a transcript, as they were originally written.
Oh, that actually may be very interesting.
Yeah, and various other things along those, that I'm thinking of doing. One thing that I did with that group in Detroit was Crowley had this plan to do with the Enochian keys, the same thing he did with the calls of the three ethers, and he had actually planned to go back out to Algeria with Victor Neuberg and do this project, and he never did. And I thought, an unfinished project of Crowley's, what a great idea. So we decided to try that ourselves. But what we did was we got, rather than just doing, someone to read the call and someone to scry, we set up three pairs of people and kind of standardized the protocol at the same time, in the same conditions, did these calls, recorded what we did, and transcribed them with the idea that we could compare what we got. We never talked about it. So it was a very, very much a controlled scientific sort of experiment so that we could compare these transcripts of each of the Enochian keys and see if there are any consistent symbols that come up. And I'm really looking forward to putting that information together and getting that out there. So again, I think it kind of ups the ante on how we can do really good magic and do really good research at the same time.
Right. Well, let's move on to actually talking about some of the aspects of Thelema. One of the things that you and I talked about in your blog was kind of the what makes a Thelemite a Thelemite, or, when does a Thelemite become a Thelemite, or when does their belief set or other things, kind of take them out of the definition of Thelemite, being a Thelemite. And, that got into the question of objectivity and relativity and things of that nature. and we didn't really kind of expand on that much on the blog because of the various conditions, but I was wondering if you've thought more about that and if you had any additional thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I have thought more about it. And the thing is, you know, this is the sort of thing that's very hard to discuss in a blog or by email because it's so slow and so much gets lost that way. But I have thought a lot about it since we had that sort of mini discussion online. And one thing that occurs to me is that, you know, if you look at the short comment to the Book of the Law, there really does seem to be this, not only a subjective element, but a very private element of thelema that's kind of enforced. When Crowley says that the study of the book is forbidden, and people who discuss its contents, you know, are shunned as centers of pestilence and so on, and that all questions of the law are to be decided by each individual for themselves. Seems to be saying that, yeah, there is a lot of latitude for personal interpretation of the Book of the Law, and that we shouldn't talk about it or debate it or get into these doctrinal points. Some of that, I think, is due to the fact that Crowley, in his own childhood, you know, was raised in a faith, the Plymouth Brethren, that schismed and splintered off, and there were people who were close family friends who were then going to hell, you know, next week, and he didn't want to see that sort of thing happening in thelema. And so I think that's some motivation to what's going on here, but at the same time, I think with an idea like thelema, where you are finding your will and doing that, and that basically is defines your whole perspective from which you define, you know, right and wrong and so on in the world, is a very relativistic sort of approach to things. So I think between those two things, that's, again, what is and isn't thelema is going to be very hard to nail down because it's a matter, I think, more of personal identification. Beyond that, I think it becomes difficult to argue.
Well, you know, it's interesting because if you draw a parallel to Christianity and what Christians, you know, like... a lot of Protestant denominations don't consider Catholics Christians, or some Protestant denominations don't think Unitarians are Christians, but Unitarians consider themselves Christians. And so, it gets into a very interesting, you know, definitional problem on whose perspective. And I don't think you're ever going to nail that down. I mean, Christianity has been around 2,000 years, and there's still this debate on who's a Christian and who's not a Christian, and what are the basic kind of tenets to Christianity. But on the other side, you know, Jews aren't Christians, and Hindus aren't Christians, nor Muslims. So there, you know, you have this relativistic aspect of what is and what is not a Christian, or maybe what is or who is not a Thelemite. But then you also have, you know, at certain points, you're going to have a hard time reconciling, you know, the worship of Allah or the worship of Jesus with a lot of the Thelemic doctrines, especially the Book of the Law. So I find it very interesting, and this is kind of a question I ask a lot of people, and I don't think there's a final answer, but, you know, it is kind of interesting to explore it from a lot of different people's perspective. So, but where do you think some of those kind of objective, real boundaries are, or do you think there are none?
Well, I think it gets hard because there are linguistic things we run into. You know, there's the idea of, and you kind of allude to this, is thelema a religion or is it a philosophy? You know, is it, a lot of Buddhists will say, you know, we do not worship Buddha, this is not a religion, it's a philosophy, and you can be, you know, a Jewish Buddhist, you can be, you know, a Hindu Buddhist, and so on. Because of the idea that there seems to be people who are rejecting, you know, the religions of their childhood, and they come into this, again, it's not true of everyone, but they're, you know, that's certainly not uncommon. There are people for whom words like religion and worship are bad words, and they get very uncomfortable with the idea. Like, I don't know, this isn't religion. This is, you know, this isn't, you know, when I go to the mass, am I, you know, monastic mass, am I going to church? You know, and because these are such loaded words. And likewise, I think when we talk about thelema, you know, there's idea of a thelemite in the sense that someone has, you know, accepted the book of the law or self-identifies with thelema and Crowley and all that stuff. But there is also this talk about, well, you know, you don't need to have ever have read the book of the law to be living like a thelemite, and in the sense that you have discovered your will and are doing it. But does that make you a thelemite if you don't know what it is, you know? And so I think people talk about thelema in different ways.
Right.
And they don't always mean the same thing when they use the word.
There are also, you know, Rabelais-based thelemites, too, who use the same label but disavow Crowley's connection or disavow the Book of the Law. So, I think you start getting to that quagmire, too, about what is and what isn't, you know, a Christian. You know, what are the basic tenets of what makes a person a Christian? What are the basic tenets that make a thelemite a thelemite? And the reason I ask these questions and I go into it is not really to get a definite answer. It's to start, you know, thinking about an individual definition, you know, because if you decide what a thelemite is to you and then you identify as a thelemite, then you kind of start looking at, well, am I, you know, living up to what my definition is? That type of situation.
Yeah. And I think that's healthy. I mean, for one to kind of come up with one's own idea of what thelema is and to hold oneself up to it. I think there's a danger in holding others up to it because there just seems to be this a tendency for, you know, for a religion where, you know, do what thou wilt is the whole of the law. There's a lot of worry amongst people about what other people are doing, you know, and I think, you know, very clearly, you know, that we ought not be worrying about what other people are doing. We should be worrying about ourselves.
Well, that's a very good point, and that actually, you know, kind of gets interesting when you start looking at group dynamics and looking at how a variety of people who self-identify as thelemites come together, and whether it's the OTO or some other group, and how the dynamics of those groups interact and how they work together, and that, how you have all of these differing definitions of what a thelemite is, and then you have some people who want a purely relativistic definition, and then you have other people who have more of an objective or more, you know, a firm definition. And all the dynamics, I think that gets very interesting and something that people should look at also.
Yeah, I mean, I for one, I love having my preconceptions challenged, and if someone comes in with a very different interpretation from mine, that to me is exciting because I can then evaluate it and see, well, what do I think of that, you know? I even think about, we were talking about, you know, Christianity is not Judaism and so on. But at the same time, I think, you know, Crowley, you know, wrote a book of mystical verse to the Virgin Mary, you know, and in the course of, you know, Bhakti Yoga, you know, in which Crowley wrote instructions, you know, it's possible one could choose a, you know, a deity from some other religion and devote oneself to it in this exercise. So in a sense, there does be a lot of latitude or at least eclecticism that is part and parcel of being a thelemite, and I think we come to expect that. So when thelemites come together in a community, you know, somebody's thing may be Hinduism, somebody else's thing may be, you know, Egyptian magic, and somebody else might be, you know, the Greek magical papyri or something, and it's all, you know, tolerated, and it's understood as being, you know, part of a territory.
Well, I really appreciate your, that you being on Thelema Coast to Coast. We've kind of gone over my time, but the conversation was so interesting that I wanted to keep it going. But unfortunately, I'm trying to keep the podcast to under an hour, and so I'm gonna have to end it here. But I would hope maybe sometime in the near future we can hook up again and continue these conversations, because I think your perspectives on things are wonderful and add a lot to the discussion. So I really appreciate you being on Thelema Coast to Coast,
And, well, thank you so much. I'll be happy to do this again anytime.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
We are now at the end of another podcast. One thing I wanted to reiterate is that this program is about Thelema. I have been contacted by a few Thelemic groups inquiring if I would mention their organization. I am certainly pleased to do so. The context I would prefer is a brief interview where someone from the organization can tell about the organization in general and how someone can contact it. If you want to spotlight your Thelemic group, email podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. I would love to hear from you. Again, keep your comments coming. I love to hear your thoughts and opinions. The best place to leave them is on the website, but you can also email. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you stick around for the next podcast. Now for the final chakra song called Red, White, and Black. Love is the law, love under will.
Aquarius, the coming of a child, the sudden coils up around the tree. Who knows what you say, but are you right? Who has journeyed far and found the silver star? Oh, it's shining brightly, red, white, and black, and the game must go on. Another prophet shall arise and bring fresh fever from the skies. Another beast shall awake the lust and worship of the snake. We believe in Thelema, the serpent and the lion, life, light, liberty, together all the time. Oh, it's shining brightly, red, white, and black, and the game must go on. Oh, it's shining brightly, red, white, and black, and the game must go on. Red, white, and black, and the game must go on.